Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, with upcoming dance performances by the Versky Ukrainian National Dance Company, the world premiere of Ralph Lemon's Geography Trilogy Part 3, Come Home Charlie Patton, the St. Petersburg State Ballet Theater's production of Romeo and Juliet, and the Mark Morris Dance Group. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com.
Have you entered the WILL sweepstakes yet? There's still time to win, but you can't win if you don't enter. Don't miss your chance to bring home a widescreen, high-definition TV from Champaign Audio, a $1,000 gift certificate from Techline, an area rug from Sweeney Brothers Rug Gallery, or an AgriFab lawn vac. Entries must be postmarked by September 6th. To request an entry form, call 217-333-0850.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. On the program Monday, let me just mention very quickly that in the first hour of the show, we'll be talking about identity theft. And our guest there will be Stephen Baker, Midwest Regional Director of the Federal Trade Commission. That's a show we had scheduled for earlier this week, and we couldn't do it on Tuesday. We have rescheduled, and that's what we'll be doing on Monday. It's an increasing problem. We'll tell you what it is and how you can protect yourself and take questions. Then in the second part of the program, we will be looking at some of the history behind the discovery of penicillin. And our guest for the show will be Eric Lax, who's authored a book that's titled The Mold on Dr. Florey's Coat, The Story of the Penicillin Miracle. A lot of people associate a scientist named Alexander Fleming with penicillin, and he was, in fact, the first scientist to discover that the penicillin mold had antibacterial properties. But it was another group of scientists led by Howard Florey who, more than 10 years later, really picked up on that work and developed the world's first viable antibiotic. And that is what the book is about, and that is the story that we will give you Monday in the 11 o'clock hour. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we're going to talk about whistleblowers. Sometimes all that stands in between the public and institutions, both private and public, could be one or the other, institutions that break the law, sometimes all that stands in between the public and these institutions is the conscience of one employee. However, deciding to be a whistleblower can be very difficult. As our guest points out this morning, in fact, it can be the most important decision that an individual ever makes. And as we know, there are certainly plenty of examples that the personal costs for these people can be very high. In this hour of Focus 580, we're talking with Tom Devine from the Government Accountability Project based in Washington, D.C. He's the legal director and co-founder of GAP. He's been working as a whistleblower advocate now for more than 25 years. He's the author of a book that's published by the Government Accountability Project titled The Whistleblower's Survival Guide. He's served as counsel on every major whistleblower law passed at the federal level since the 80s. He's also author of the whistleblower provisions of the Organization of American States anti-corruption law, and he regularly appears before audiences all over to talk about whistleblower protection and also issues of occupational free speech and national security. He is based in Washington, D.C. This morning, he happens to be in California. He's talking with us by telephone. And as always, questions from people who are listening are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask is people just try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving. But anybody's welcome to call 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Devine, hello.
Howdy.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Maybe we should give you the opportunity just a little bit at the beginning here to talk some more about the Government Accountability Project.
Well, sure. I'm glad to. We're an anti-secrecy group, so I don't want to hide anything, but I don't want to waste too much time on the interview on GAP. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan, public interest organization. Our reason to be is supporting whistleblowers. And this is a term that's almost like beauty or truth. It's in the eye of the beholder. But what we mean, the people that we champion, are employees who exercise free speech rights to challenge abuses of power that betray the public trust. And usually they're abuses of power that can only continue because they're being conducted in secret. They're so indefensible that if the folks who are affected by it were aware of what's going on, it would have to stop. And we do it in four ways. One is just representing clients, like regular trial lawyers in hearings to defend their jobs when they're fired or harassed. A second is following through on their dissent. What they were challenging is improper. And all too often, the whistleblower gets so sucked into a struggle for survival, for professional survival. We nickname it the sound of professional suicide, and we call whistleblowing committing the truth because you're treated like you committed a crime. And the point of the dissent gets lost in that struggle. And we do open up investigations to expand their beachhead into the full story. A third thing that we do is work very, very hard to try and strengthen the laws protecting freedom of dissent, whistleblowing in public policy context. And actually, that's why I was pleased to be able to talk with your listeners this morning. There's a very, very striking anomaly in our country that corporate workers, as a result of the Enron and MCI scandals, have probably the strongest free speech rights in the world now, and they've always been, you know, a little better than serfs if they weren't in a union labor management contract. They could be fired at will, and they didn't have any free speech rights. You might as well have been a totalitarian society on the job. But now they can go to court and have jury trials if they're harassed for defending the shareholders against misconduct that would threaten investments, threaten stock values, or really any significant misconduct. But the government workers are absolutely the opposite. They have a Whistleblower Protection Act, which was passed in 1989, and on paper was the strongest free speech law in history. And thanks to very almost obsessively hostile activist court with a monopoly on judicial review and being subjected to kind of minor league bureaucratic boards for their day in court, it's become a Trojan horse. And the Whistleblower Protection Act for federal workers is creating more victims than it helps. It's a trap. And our group, which fought for years to get that law passed, in fact, it was kind of my professional baby back in the 80s, when my baby grew up to be Frankenstein. And we have to warn people against asserting their rights because they'll finish themselves off if they do.
Yeah. There have been people who have been whistleblowers in government and in the private sector, and there are some names that maybe, you know, some people will recognize, everybody from probably one of the most famous federal whistleblowers, Ernie Fitzgerald, who did that. He worked in the Pentagon and blew the whistle about problems with procurement. And then you have guys like Jeff Wigand, who was the scientist who worked for the tobacco company and blew the whistle about what they knew about the dangers of smoking. And, of course, his story went on to become a book and then went on to become a movie. So, you know, there are examples here and there of different people, different circumstances, public sector, private sector. What is it, though? Is there something, in fact, that they all have in common? And what is it that prompts them to do this? And they must have the knowledge that it's not going to be easy for them.
I think what they all have in common you could describe on two levels. One is that they're exercising freedom of speech to challenge conventional wisdom, whether it's the party line or I viewed Copernicus and Galileo as whistleblowers for challenging the idea that the world was flat and the Earth is the center of the universe. And they got the whistleblower treatment, too. The other thing that they have in common is that they just can't live with keeping quiet about something they know. They can't keep their mouth shut. They can't keep it to themselves and live with themselves. And the motives can be from the noblest to the basest. Sometimes they just can't keep quiet because they want to get revenge against someone, or they want to use their knowledge to help amass power themselves. Other times there are people who are willing to risk everything for the values that they've been raised with, kind of like the people who religious people who live their church values every day of the week instead of just on Sundays. There's really no way to stereotype, generalize that a whistleblower is necessarily a hero or a jerk. It's part of what makes us human. And retaliation, on the other hand, is I've long ago stopped thinking that this is something that's just evil, that you harass somebody who exposes a cover-up. It's like the institutional equivalent of an animal instinct. When an animal is threatened, it tries to eliminate the threat. And like if someone hits me, slugs me, I don't think, maybe I had that coming, or what's the lesson I could learn from it. My reaction is to hit them back, eliminate the threat, and also I want to get even. Right. This is life, that people are going to challenge the convention of wisdom. It's always happened throughout history, they're going to be taking a lot of risk whenever they do that, whenever they challenge the crowd or what the people who have power are saying. And boy, what a tough decision. Yeah. It's one of those life's crossroads decisions that you'll never be the same again. It's for better or worse. And I've seen people who have they've grown and blossomed because they knew who they were. They knew that they could count on themselves to be true to their values, and that they overcame fear in order to stand up to something that was wrong. And sometimes, regardless of the result, they end up that way. There's other people who are just ruined by it. They lose their professional lives, their bank accounts, their families. That's a very common breakup from the stress of your whole world caving in. Have nervous breakdowns. Many can just be bitter for the rest of their lives because they did the right thing, and this is the way the world treated them. It's one of those moments in life where you decide what values are going to define my life versus what's cheap talk, what's just lip service.
Is it ever possible for a whistleblower to remain anonymous?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, another book that I co-authored is called The Art of Anonymous Activism. Deep Throat was one of the most effective whistleblowers in history. We're all still scratching our heads and speculating about who that person was. Oftentimes, you can be much more effective being anonymous rather than publicly being in the face of whoever's misconduct you're trying to challenge. Because once a whistleblower exposes him or herself, it triggers a whole series of almost predictable automatic institutional reactions. And besides, at a minimum, making that person a pariah and putting them under investigation and everything else, the whistleblower is liable to be isolated from coworkers and cut off from the evidence, be out of the loop. It's impossible to turn information into power to make a difference when you stop having that information. And you go from being an insider, like Jeffrey Wigand, to being the outsider who nobody tells anything to. So it can cripple your effectiveness. And this is another very personal choice that we help people make at the Government Accountability Project. Do they want to take the risk of being exposed? Sooner or later, they'll probably have to. come out of the closet and bear witness, give testimony at some point. But if they're willing to accept that inevitability, then at what point do they stop being confidential and maybe stop having the inside sources of information and evidence flowing to them? There's many people who just they want to get something off their chest, but they don't want to risk martyrdom. They don't want to become an outcast among many of their peers and friends and coworkers. And for them, the right thing to do might be just calling a confidential hotline. They're not very effective because it's hard to have any follow-through, but at least they'll have a clean conscience, and they'll get it off their chest, and then they can move on from something. A very personal choice, and we don't try to tell people which choice to make. We try to make sure that they have their eyes open for whatever they choose. And I tell you the reason we wrote that book, The Art of Anonymous Activism, is because the federal laws are such caricatures. They're like 1984, or you know, some of the things that the political critics talk about now, with peace being war. You know, it's so hopeless to try to defend yourself under the free speech laws for government workers that you're virtually guaranteed that you're going to spend 2 or 3 years of your life just dragging out and reliving this nightmare. You're not going to wake up from it. And probably $40,000 or $50,000 in attorney fees in order to get a guaranteed ruling that you had it coming, and an endorsement of whatever harassment that you were trying to challenge. In fact, that's happened 94 out of 95 times in the court with a monopoly on judicial review since Congress passed the strongest free speech law in history on paper. It's one of these real anomalies. And our group, sadly, our job is to blow the whistle on the law that we helped to get passed, that we led the campaign to get passed, because it's just been totally twisted and gutted in its implementation.
We have a caller I will get right to in a moment. For everyone else, I would like to introduce again our guest. Maybe you've just tuned in. We're talking this morning with Tom Devine. He is the legal director and the co-founder of the Government Accountability Project. It's based in Washington, D.C. It's the nation's leading whistleblower organization. It was founded in 1977, and among other things, they're interested in advocating for occupational free speech. They've also been involved in litigating whistleblower cases and publicizing the concerns of whistleblowers. And if you have questions, you can certainly call us. We do have someone here ready to go on our line number one, a caller here in Champaign County. Hello.
Good morning. I see your name is associated with a corporate responsibility project, too, and I'm wondering how philosophically you can tie them together, in the sense that, you know, we have this campaign of privatization, and one of the publicly traded companies are regulated governmentally, so there's that entree. But I wanted you to just talk about that, but also if you could get to some specifics about your work with the whistleblowers, I think both corporate and governmental, in the monumental scandal in Iraq, which I think it's Abu Ghraib has visuals, and the $8 billion unaccounted for in Iraq, I don't know. I think I can imagine that fairly clearly. But if you would talk about those things,
well, I'm glad to. And at Gap, we don't care which bureaucracy is selling out the public, whether it's government or corporate. But there are a tremendous amount of abuses in the corporate sector. And for example, we represented whistleblowers who were challenging nuclear power plants under construction in the 80s that were accidents waiting to happen, and take 50 to 100 affidavits from whistleblowers who were telling the truth about the way these things were really being constructed. And it led to the government turning on the corporations that they had kind of been colluding with, in bed with, and requiring such major repairs so that the plants would be lawful, that the utilities actually would convert them to other sources of energy like gas gas plants or coal-fired facilities. We helped whistleblowers at toxic incinerators that were burning dioxin and heavy metals like arsenic and mercury and horrible poisons, and PCBs, right next to churches and schoolyards in poor areas. And thanks to those whistleblowers, the plants were relocated, the incinerators were relocated, or they were shut down. In the area of meat and poultry inspection, we represent corporate workers all the time, so that things like the Jack in the Box scandal or tragedy don't become, it stays the rule rather than the exception. And thanks to those corporate whistleblowers, our country has stopped deregulation of government-approved food, where there would be corporate honor systems vouching for the USDA seal of approval on four occasions since 1981, when we first started working with corporate whistleblowers there. Now, what you said about Abu Ghraib is very, very insightful, because it was a whistleblower who exposed the human rights abuses at Abu Ghraib after the whole Pentagon public information apparatus said they didn't know anything about it. A whole government agency was deceiving our Congress. And one G.I. Joe committed the truth and a nightmare that made a caricature of the point of our stated reasons for being in that country was exposed. And that soldier was operating without any rights. There's a Military Whistleblower Protection Act that our group helped get passed, but you don't have any rights for making disclosures through the chain of command under the military law. It's like a lot of these laws. They're so chock full of loopholes that I'd say it's kind of like driving down a road with more potholes than pavement. You're going to ruin your transmission or your career. And that loophole is being closed thanks to the Abu Ghraib whistleblower. The Senate has said that now you'll have free speech rights for challenging military misconduct to your commanding officer or to your superior officer.
There were death threats against the guy, actually, in his community, too, so he's suffering from the repercussions. But I also wanted you, if you could, get at the corporate malfeasance in Iraq that has to do with, you know, the amount of money that's being skimming. And there were specifically some insiders in Halliburton who did come forward, but I haven't heard anything much more about them, and I'm just wondering whether you have anything specific on that. And I guess I'll hang up and listen to the rest. Thank you for your work.
Thank you for caring. And the Halliburton whistleblowers in Iraq illustrated a real phenomenon of fraud in government contracts. And actually, that's the one area where the law is working for whistleblowers wanting to challenge that type of fraud. It's something with noble roots from where you live and where I came from, Illinois, a law that was called the Lincoln Law, the False Claims Act is its official title. That allows private citizens to blow the whistle with deeds more than just making noise. They can go to court and on behalf of the Treasury, on behalf of our country, sue government contractors who engage in fraud. And the law is kind of, it's genius, as it combines doing well with doing good. If they prevail in the whistleblower suit, they get to keep anywhere from 10% to 25% of the recovery to the taxpayers. This was first passed during the Civil War by President Lincoln, because defense contractors were just as shoddy then as they are now, and there were too many Union troops getting killed by their own weapons, backfiring or not working in life and death situations. And so he got this law passed to basically deputize the citizens to go to court and challenge fraud. And over the years, it got eroded, like most all laws. It was pretty much irrelevant until it was revived in the 1980s by Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa, our neighbor, and a liberal Democratic congressman from California, Howard Berman. Senator Grassley is a Republican senator. And since the law was born again, it's been the most effective anti-fraud statute on the books. Just to give you a flavor, in 1985, before it was revived, before this law was modernized, the Justice Department had a civil division and collected $27 million from fraud in government contracts. And it was a big year for them. They usually would collect like $7 to $9 million. Well, in the first 10 years after the False Claims Act was revived, that average went up to $300 million a year, which was a real healthy boost when we deputized the whistleblowers, enfranchised them to follow through in court. Then the last 3 years, the recoveries have been over $1 billion a year. Last year alone in one Medicare case, the recovery was $1.5 billion. And this just shows how much of an impact these folks can have. Your example, sir, actually is very insightful of the challenge that we face right now, however. The Halliburton whistleblowers, they were sponsored by one of GAP's sister organizations, the Project on Government Oversight. You can see all their testimony and statements on their website, www.pogo.org, which reminds me to tell you about ours, too, in the Whistleblower Rights Campaign we're working, www.whistleblowersingular.org. But they weren't allowed to testify in Congress. The chair of the House Government Reform Committee, Tom Davis, declined to allow them to bear witness in the hearings. And it's Mr. Davis who is the gatekeeper for whether the whistleblower law will be modernized and made credible again in the House of Representatives. And if the jury is out, whether he's going to allow the legislation to even have a vote or have a vote in the form that it's been approved in the Senate committee. The campaign to restore a genuine whistleblower protection law for government workers has been going on for about 5 years now. And I won't get too bogged down here, but separately describe why this is creating so many victims. But after a lot of hard work, the Senate Government Affairs Committee last month voted, passed it unanimously. Everyone from people like Senator Sununu and Senator Bennett and from the conservative Republicans to Senator Durbin and Senator Levin from the liberal Democrats. One of the heroes of it was Senator Fitzgerald of Illinois, whose committee, he headed the subcommittee that had to make the first approval, and his staff worked very hard, and they got it out of there. Senator Susan Collins of Maine, another Republican, sponsored and adopted the legislation. But we expect there to be a unanimous Senate passage of the law soon. And it closes all sorts of loopholes that have deprived people like national security whistleblowers trying to prevent another 9/11 from being unable to defend themselves when their security clearances are pulled, which is a great way to brand somebody a traitor, and they can't really even defend themselves. Whistleblower law doesn't apply there. To overturning all the hostile decisions that have made the current law just a nightmare. And we haven't gotten to first base in the House of Representatives. And Chairman Davis's staff has said they want to work on this, but the only thing they've expressed any openness to would just be sort of window dressing. And so there's a real need for folks like yourself and everyone else listening to this show to get in touch with your congressman. In the Senate, we're doing real well. They're going to pass a strong whistleblower law for government workers. But in the House, there needs to be some healthy pressure. And Congressman Tim Johnson can make a difference if you let him know you expect it of him. The House of Representatives, you want him to make sure that the Government Reform Committee and the leadership, Mr. Hastert, find time to vote on the Whistleblower Protection Act. It's been nicknamed the Taxpayer Protection Act when it was passed before. It's just been so effective going after fraud and waste. And the only way this law won't get restored is if it's killed in the back rooms by politicians who try to pretend it doesn't exist or say we don't have time for it. It's passed unanimously in the past, and doesn't take long to take a half an hour to give rights to the people who are sticking up for the taxpayers, sticking their necks out. And one of the real lessons I've learned at the Government Accountability Project is it's not realistic to expect government workers to defend the public if they can't defend themselves. Profiles and courage, they're the exception, not the rule. And every year, there's about a half a million government workers who witness government illegality or waste mismanagement that costs the taxpayers over $500,000 just from their personal observations. And they remain, keep their mouths shut, they remain silent observers. A major reason is they can't defend themselves if they stick their necks out for this and start getting harassed. And people don't like to become martyrs. So get in touch with Congressman Johnson. You can reach him at 403-4690, his district office. And I guarantee you, if he hears from 20 to 30 people listening to this program, he's going to get on the phone to Chairman Davis and say, what's holding up the Whistleblower Protection Act? You can make a difference.
Okay. Well, we have another caller here to talk with, someone listening this morning in Urbana, so we'll go there. Line number one. Hello.
I was wondering about, I'd like to say that it doesn't sound like you believe in team playing too much, though I'm being a little facetious there since I believe in your cause. But I just wanted to know what you might say. It sounded like you've kind of addressed it by saying it doesn't really apply, but the most interesting whistleblower to me in the last few months has been that Sybil Edmonds. She says she knows about, you know, that the FBI knew that that there were real plans in place to attack the U.S. with aircraft months before the strikes happened, and can you tell us anything about her situation that you might know about? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Oh, absolutely. She's a classic illustration of what we call the Paul Revere whistleblowers. And since 9/11, a majority of we used to mainly help people who were challenging environmental misconduct that are consumer safety issues. Consumer protection. But since 9/11, there's just a surge of national security whistleblowers who pretty obviously were motivated by patriotism. We call them the Paul Revere whistleblowers because they really haven't been using free speech to exercise the freedom to protest. They illustrate another very important value of free speech, the freedom to warn. They had been warning for years that the terrorists are coming. We're not ready. We're not prepared. We've helped folks cross the board on this at nuclear power plants who revealed, and nuclear weapons facilities, that a year after 9/11, we still didn't even have any contingency plans to if a plane crashed into Los Alamos, the capital of nuclear weapons development in the world, didn't even have a plan for it. Or at the airports, they had been warning for years that we were sitting ducks to anybody who wanted to hijack a plane. And in fact, whistleblowers had done they'd teamed up with a local television station and breached security at the same gates that the hijackers used on 9/11 a few months before the tragedy, and the FAA declined to do anything that would interfere with the airline's carrier schedules. They made so much noise about it. It just goes across the board with these type of whistleblowers. Ms. Edmonds is, has a very, very, very honorable, gutsy colleague named Colleen Rowling, who you may remember was one of the persons of the year about 2 years ago for Time Magazine, a year and a half ago. And Ms. Rowling is working very hard with us to try and get the whistleblower rights restored for government workers. She had no idea the vacuum of freedom that she was entering when she exercised her right to warn Congress, to alert Congress that we'd missed an opportunity. And what she said about team playing is gets right to the heart of some of the contradictions involving whistleblowing. But, it's most whistleblowers feel they're doing this as part of their duty on the team, or to defend the best interest of the team. They're not trying to bring down the corporation that they're working at, or reduce the budget of the government agency where they're at. They think their organization is going to get in trouble if it continues to cover up abuses of power that are betraying its mission. And I really agree with them. Teams ultimately don't do very well by cheating. And you've seen that with all the track stars whose careers are over because they tried to cheat. Most whistleblowers are trying to act to defend the organization where they work, to defend its integrity, and see that it really gets the results that it promises to the public. But it puts them in the position of being branded as traitors or people who aren't team players. That's unfortunate. And sometimes it's true. It takes all kinds. I was saying earlier, some people are whistleblowers because they're kind of cantankerous. They're type A personalities. But so often they're sticking their necks out in the most painful choice of their life in defense of the team that they're part of, because they're afraid that otherwise it's going to be ruined.
We have about 15 minutes left, and I just want to tell again people, anybody who might have tuned in, that our guest this morning is Tom Devine. He's the legal director and co-founder of the Government Accountability Project. It was founded in 1977. It's a nonprofit public interest organization. It's the nation's leading whistleblower organization. They're interested in promoting government and corporate accountability by advocating for occupational free speech and also by litigating whistleblower cases. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We talked about the fact that there is this legislation that was passed to try to provide some protection for federal government employees and the problems with it, and how now you're trying to strengthen that or strengthen their rights by legislation that has come out of committee in the Senate. Probably, you say you think it probably will pass in the Senate, but the problem is in the House. I'm curious about what the situation is for state employees, and is that just a matter of legislation from one state to another? Are there states, for example, that have whistleblower protection for their workers?
Yes, there are. Over 30 states have whistleblower protection for government workers. Actually, 40 have corporate rights through the common law system. They call it the public policy exception to the at-will doctrine. They're kind of hit or miss the boundaries of those rights. But the states do, and that's another major reason. In Illinois, passed a False Claims Act. So if anyone's listening to your program and they get evidence of a fraud in a state government contract, they would have the right to go to court and challenge it and share in the recovery if they win. But that's another reason we really need to restore legitimacy to the federal law, because it's being copied by the states in so many instances. And let me just give you a flavor of why the federal law has turned into a bad joke. It's like a magnet for cynicism among government workers. The loopholes in it. There's so many loopholes, it's too long of a list, but a few of them. That the whistleblower law doesn't apply. And the law on paper says it applies to any disclosure that's genuine evidence of serious misconduct. But any doesn't count if you're talking to a coworker, which means you can be isolated, you can't get supporting witnesses. It doesn't count if you talk to your boss, which is where 95% of people naturally go and say, hey, boss, we got a problem. Will you waive all your free speech rights if you do that? It doesn't apply for information that you learn about from doing your job, which is supposed to be the point of government workers being able to be public servants instead of bureaucrats. It has to be like personal eccentricity that you learned about on your off time. And the real kicker for me is that it doesn't apply if anyone has ever raised the issue before. So if you're not the Christopher Columbus of your scandal, you proceed at your own risk. You can't go after ingrained corruption. You can't be a supporting witness for a pioneer whistleblower. And then the people who exercise their rights and are screened out for that reason, they're the lucky ones. If you get past all that gauntlet of loopholes, you're going to get a ruling that you deserved to be fired. And that's because this court is rewritten the congressional statute, the language. The language of the law Congress passed said, you have free speech rights if you disclose information that you reasonably believe is evidence of listed misconduct. That's fair enough, and it's a very common boundary. But this court, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, said, well, before you get to that, you first have to overcome a presumption. Legally, those words presumption triggers the Pandora's box of sophistry, lawyer sophistry. And the presumption is that the government acts correctly, fairly, lawfully, and in good faith, which is a little bit hard to swallow. But the real kicker is the proof you have to present to overcome that presumption. It's irrefragable proof. And I'll tell you, I'd never heard of that word before. But we tracked it down to Webster's Fourth New Collegiate, and irrefragable means incontrovertible, uncontestable, undeniable, or incapable of being overthrown. And what that basically means is if the personal wrongdoer doesn't confess, you deserve to be fired for challenging whatever misconduct you witnessed. And if the personal wrongdoer confesses, who needs a whistleblower? this case came out, and this doctrine came out overturning an administrative ruling on behalf of a whistleblower who had challenged Air Force pork barrel that was so outrageous. The Secretary of the Air Force agreed, in Las Vegas, in Las Vegas base. The Secretary of the Air Force agreed and canceled the pork barrel program. But the local base commander was a poor sport and exiled this professional, this expert, out into the desert, 70 miles outside of Las Vegas. They made a temporary little tin office building, stripped him of all his duties, and they sent him out there and paid him to sweat, like professional solitary confinement. And the court ruled he had it coming because he didn't have irrefragable proof. And this legislation to restore the Whistleblower Protection Act would sweep all that aside and establish normal access to court so that government workers weren't prisoners of a system that's pretty much structured now to create victims if they defend the public.
From now on, in my daily conversation, I'm going to see if I can work irrefragable in. That's a good word. How much of this do you think, and particularly the reaction of the federal courts, does it have something to do with the perceived need for secrecy in government, and that is somehow tied particularly to concerns about national security since the 11th of September 2001?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. But this one court that's got a monopoly on the federal workers' rights is way out of sync with the courts that have done rulings for the corporate whistleblower laws, the normal national judicial system. In fact, we did a study, and almost everyone who had won in appeals court under the corporate whistleblower law would have lost under the doctrines of the for the federal workers, but the courts pick those up at the state level and municipal level as sort of what defines the rules of the game, and they apply them against state government workers as well. Absolutely, in response to your question,
the fact that it is maybe more difficult even now than it has been, particularly because of the attitude of the courts toward whistleblowers, has that had a noticeable effect on the number of people who are willing to do it, to be whistleblowers?
You know, that's the interesting thing is it has gone down, but the information is still out there. And in fact, the government's really cracking down on it. One of the big lessons we've learned at Gap is, even in terms of national security, secrecy can be a very severe threat to national security. Of course, sometimes it's good, but everything has to have a balance. If it's too far in one direction, it becomes a caricature. And secrecy threatens national security when it covers up bureaucratic negligence that sustained our vulnerability to terrorists. The federal government is cracking down more in a more ugly, repressive fashion to defend secrecy than at any time since the 1970s when I came to the Government Accountability Project. And in fact, you might remember when the FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowling was on the cover of Time magazine. They said it's the year of the whistleblower. And at Gap, we've nicknamed 2004 the year of the gag. And let me give you a few examples of government employees who tried to warn the public. And these people were all threatened with termination or placed under criminal investigation for leaking information. One example was the prescription drug bill, where the chief Medicare actuary was told he would be fired if he communicated with Congress the true price tag of that law, which was $140 billion more than the government was, the administration was telling Congress. And that law only passed by a couple of votes. I doubt it would have passed if they'd known the truth. There was an FDA scientist who tried to blow the whistle on, and did successfully, on near approval of antidepressants for teenagers that were causing them to commit suicide rather than helping them deal with their emotional problems. He was literally given a script that he had to read, or one of the FDA scientists was given a script to read in response to any public questions about this drug, and it was just propaganda. Or at the Department of Agriculture, the meat inspectors and veterinarians have been exposing that the much-publicized reform against mad cow disease is actually structured to miss the worst suspects, and that the cows that even fit into the narrow criteria aren't actually always being tested. Or at TSA, Transportation Security Administration, that guns are still getting through the airplanes. Despite everything they make us do in the long lines and taking off our shoes, they haven't made the reforms to keep guns off the planes or to keep explosives from being smuggled in through the cargoes. At the Department of Energy, they had all these tests to prove that the nuclear weapons plants could defend themselves against a terrorist attack. And thanks to a whistleblower, the government passed with flying colors and beat those terrorists every time. Whistleblowers exposed that, as a matter of fact, the tests were rigged.
Are you still there, Mr. Devine? Well, we appear to have lost the guest, but we're pretty much at the end of the show anyway, so maybe we'll just say we want to make sure that we thank him for his time. We've been talking here this morning with Tom Devine. He's legal director, co-founder of the Government Accountability Project in Washington, D.C., founded in 1977. It's an organization that represents whistleblowers. And if you are interested in finding out more about GAP, the Government Accountability Project, you can, and if you have access to the internet, you can look at their website, which is www.whistleblower.org. You can find out all about them and their activities. Our guest, Tom Devine, is author of a book that's published by the Government Accountability Project. It's entitled The Whistleblower's Survival Guide. Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Just again, a quick reminder that Monday morning in the 10 o'clock hour, first hour of the show, we'll be talking about identity theft, what it is and how you can protect yourself. Our guest will be Stephen Baker. He's Midwest Regional Director of the Federal Trade Commission based in Chicago. Then in the second part of the program, we'll be exploring some of the history of the discovery and development of penicillin. And our guest will be Eric Lax. He's the author of a book that's titled The Mold on Dr. Florey's Coat: The Story of the Penicillin Miracle. That'll be Monday at 11. We are here weekday mornings from 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. We hope you'll stay tuned now because much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with Alan Metcalf. He's the author of several books on language. His latest is Presidential Voices, Speaking Styles from George Washington to George W. Bush. He is a professor of English at McMurray College and executive secretary of the American Dialect Society. Alan Metcalf, our guest this afternoon following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. September wheat trading at $3 even, down 5 3/4. December, 3.12 3/4, down 6. September corn, 2.21 3/4, down 3.5. December, 2.30 1/4, down 3 3/4. March corn, 2.38 1/2, down 3 3/4. December corn, 2.55 3/4, down 1. September.